You're listening to the new security broadcast from the Wilson Center's Environmental Change and Security Program. I'm Angus Soderberg, and today's episode is part of The Arc, a special series that explores connections between climate change impacts, our climate responses, and justice. In this episode, my colleague Claire Doyle and I are excited to host Nisha Singh and Kaveen Murthy Khan from Women for Women International. Nisha is Senior Global Policy and Advocacy Manager, and Kaveen is Program Manager for Iraq, and both have extensive experience working at the intersection of the international advocacy, humanitarian, and gender spaces.
In our conversation today, we dive into a recent Women for Women report called Cultivating a More Enabling Environment, Strengthening Women's Resilience in Climate Vulnerable and Conflict-Affected Communities. We talk with Nisha and Kaveen about why Women for Women saw the need for a report on this intersection, what some of their findings are, and the report's recommendations. We also hear from Kaveen in Iraq about the experiences of women in climate-vulnerable and conflict-affected communities there.
Nisha and Kaveen, we're absolutely delighted to have you on the podcast. Nisha, you work on global policy at Women for Women International, so you have a bird's eye view of the organization's work. Could you tell us a little bit about the organization and the work you do globally?
Absolutely. So Women for Women International, since 1993, so over 30 years now, has supported over 530,000 women survivors of war and conflict in 16 countries, through the provision of direct programs or through our support to local partners. So wherever we do have offices in countries where we're implementing programs, we offer our core program, which is our Stronger Women, Stronger Nations program. And that offers informational training, skills building, connects women to networks in their communities, and also provides resources, which includes a monthly cash stipend to women survivors of war, who also often face other compounding challenges such as poverty or illiteracy. And in addition to strengthening those women's capacity and their resilience directly through these programs, we also try to strengthen the enabling environment surrounding them so that they're better enabled to realize their rights and their power. So we also implement a men's engagement program to engage men as allies and support systems for women's empowerment. And we also have a change agent program to support women in becoming community advocates and leaders who are able to influence formal and informal power structures in their lives so that they can tackle the issues that matter to them. So that can be gender-based violence or peace building or securing land rights for women. And it's those issues, actually, that the change agents identify as their priorities that then make their way into our global policy and advocacy agenda. So anything that makes its way into my daily work or as my daily priority, it comes directly from the communities and from the women that we serve. And we're really a learning organization. So we're constantly seeking feedback from women, not just to improve our programs, but also to shape our own advocacy at the global level.
So as you noted, Women for Women does a lot of work on the ground, working with women in different regions. And Kaveen, you're Women for Women's program manager in Iraq. Can you share from your perspective what Women for Women's work looks like on the ground in Iraq?
So as Nisha has been giving this global abbreviation on the how the programs of Women for Women works, as a core program, Stronger Women, Stronger Nation is a 12-month program that supports socially and economically the women, the vulnerable women in the country. And also we cut after that to support their empowerment, and we provide the Change Agent program, which is an advocacy program that empower their leadership skills, their communication skills, their decision-making skills to be more involved and advocate for their community issues on the country level. We also have the other program that is also supporting the women, which called Men Engagement Program, the main allies of our participants. Our main target is that to target the spouses or the male members of our participants so we can make them both a balance between the two understanding of issues related to economic, social, and how a healthy family could be. And those programs have been implemented in Iraq. And so far, they are like very positive feedback that we are receiving for the men themselves when they join the program and how they are feeling okay, they recognize the role of the woman, even if they were like a simple household, that they previously look at it as their main role, but now they appreciate that they are doing the household work, they appreciate they are raising the children and managing the house. So there are issues that the men have reported themselves to me that they have not recognized before, but now they recognize and appreciate the role of women in their life. And this is a very positive approach that we are implementing on the ground, and we are seeing the perspective, positive feedback from them directly.
Thank you. That's really great to hear. Nisha, you mentioned that Women for Women has been working for over 30 years in the gender and conflict space. And you talked a little bit about some of the compounding factors that you think about as well in your work, like poverty and illiteracy. And kind of in that vein, I want to turn now to your recent work on climate change too, as an additional compounding factor. So in December of last year, you published a new report that not only looks at conflict and gender, but also how those issues are intersecting with climate change. In the report, you looked at women's resilience in climate vulnerable and conflict affected communities. So Nisha, turning to you, what drove Women for Women International to produce this report? You know, what motivated you to incorporate a climate lens into the work of your organization?
Yeah, I mean, we already knew that climate change or conflict-driven environmental degradation was affecting the communities where we work because we were already having to adapt for it in our program delivery. We needed to respond to those challenges and to those shocks. So for example, we offer vocational training tracks in our core programming, and they're often agriculture related. And so in the context where there might be droughts or flooding, we were already having to adapt and are still adapting our offerings to ensure that they can be resistant to those shocks and that encourages women's resilience. And they were also telling us, women will tell us first that, you know, this isn't working because of, you know, whatever the challenge might be. So we knew it was a growing challenge that we would have to face programmatically. And even from, you know, zooming out from what we were hearing from the women in our programs, we already knew that many of the places where we work are not only affected by conflict and poverty, but they're among some of the most climate vulnerable in the world. But we also knew that women that we were working with weren't necessarily talking about these challenges in the way that the international community was, or the way that I just did, you know, in beginning my response to your questions, using terms like conflict-related environmental degradation, right? This was not going to help us connect the dots to understand this challenge better, but we did want to understand how exactly these issues were affecting their lives and interacting with the other barriers they face to their resilience, whether it's socially or economically.
Yeah, that's great. It sounds like it came kind of from the ground, from your observations in communities, but also, of course, informed by international conversations on this already. So kind of bridging those two levels. So as part of the report, you spoke with nearly 1,000 women across, I think, something like 13 countries. From that work, can you give us a sense of how conflict and climate are disproportionately impacting women across the globe? What are some of the common themes that you found in speaking with these women? And did anything surprise you?
Well, yeah, we wanted to speak with as many women as we could through women who are recipients of our program or participating in our program, but also through local partners. And we knew that women would have a unique perspective due to their unique roles in their families and in their communities, and that the challenges they face on a daily basis were likely being exacerbated, and that they might already be adapting and developing solutions. So we really wanted to hear from women to understand the unique and disproportionate impact of this climate conflict intersection on women and their resilience, but also how they might already be adapting, what we could learn from them and their solutions. So what we found, you know, in our report, which includes some country-specific snapshots, so you can see in a little bit more detail what exactly is happening in Afghanistan, the DRC, Iraq, Nigeria, Rwanda, and South Sudan. But there were some overarching findings that were true to some degree across all of those contexts. And the first is that women really connected these issues and framed these issues in relation to their daily realities, which sounds really intuitive and obvious. So for example, they were talking about climatic and environmental shocks in relation to how it impacted their health, their children's health, their family's health, their experience of food security. So again, that seems obvious, but I think particularly as an organization that does take a women-centered approach, we don't really see international actors who are engaged in this space taking the steps to connect those dots in their programming around climate adaptation and mitigation. In these contexts, they're not necessarily aiming to relate their work or their understanding of the issues to the daily realities of the people who are living through these shocks. So that means that the solutions that they're proposing are not going to be sustainable, or they're not going to reach the women or the communities that we work with, who are often considered the sort of like last mile as far as programming goes, or, you know, don't have access due to the other intersecting challenges that they face or barriers that they face. So this really helped us to identify climate justice rather than just mitigation or adaptation as a better mechanism for approaching solutions or framework to understanding the challenges. We also really heard clearly this relationship between conflict and environmental degradation as a cycle. So, you know, it's hard to pinpoint what starts first, but we know that there are these environmental disasters, whether they're natural or human-made, and that that may result in a shift in weather patterns or, you know, otherwise affect farming activities in particular. So this was mainly where the majority of the population is engaged in agricultural activities, and that includes women. And that leads to less availability of resources, a significant one of which is fertile land for farming or water sources. And so with the few, when there are also few adaptation mechanisms available, this leads to displacement. Women and their families are often forced to migrate in order to maintain their livelihoods. This increases resource competition and increases insecurity and conflict experiences. And whenever there's conflict, there's an increased experience of violence for women. That includes gender-based violence. So this local conflict rises, and then environmental destruction is also a result of that, you know, as maybe different communities that are in conflict with each other might be burning the, you know, farming land of their quote unquote competitors or the people that are competing with them for their resources. So, you know, and then it just repeats, right? There's again, less available resources for everyone. So this cycle is a really challenging one, and it's why the relationship between climate justice and peace building is an important one to recognize. And then just the short and long-term impact of active war and conflict on climate was really clear. There's sort of the immediate term, you know, pollution, for example, that results from bombings. So women that we spoke with who are living in more active conflict settings or in the midst of war, they talked a lot about how women and their children talk about, like, you know, pollution and how it affects their breathing and their lungs. And again, the relationship between climatic shock or war and their health came out really clearly. Also, it reduces women's ability to actually, you know, consider climate as a priority, which is very obvious. So, you know, there's an increase in, for example, burning of plastic, which then further increases pollution. But they're like, well, we don't have any fuel available. There's, you know, there's blockades, there's whatever. And then most importantly, I think across conflict and post-conflict settings, women talked about the damaged infrastructure, which is never repaired after a conflict ends, or it's really deprioritized in reconstruction processes. And then that, again, it makes them less resilient to these shocks and to water shortages or food insecurity, or, you know, there's no health clinic. So all of these challenges that result, the communities and women especially are less resilient to those challenges. And they said, you know, they really called for better infrastructure as a post-conflict priority.
Iraq is one of those country-specific snapshots that you mentioned in the report. Kaveen, you're based in Iraq, which is consistently identified as one of the most vulnerable countries to climate change on top of its ongoing instability. Maybe for our listeners who are less familiar with the context of Iraq, could you briefly share some of the major climate impacts, give us like a kind of a broad overview, and then kind of some of the key conflict and instability concerns?
Thank you. So yeah, the really that like in Iraq, especially for women in Iraq, indeed, the climate change has double burden. Plus with the conflict, it double burden the extreme vulnerability situation of women. For example, if you look at it in the climate change or agricultural phase areas, we can see that droughts, extreme weather hit, rising temperature, or all these are impacting the agricultural production and increasing the displacement communities. So if they are not displaced by the conflict, they are displaced now because of the water shortage and droughts in the area. And this is like reducing the water resources. This affects disproportionately the burden between women responsible for like their water fetching, for food security, for childcare. We had this example from one of our camps from last week, that the infrastructure of water pipe in the camp are not well functioned because they were temporary base, basically. But now it's like for them, it has been 10 years to over for the refugee camps, for example, over for 10 years that they have been based in these camps. And the water shortage is really impacting their daily life. So we had this scenario that the neighborhood are not getting the water and the government are not able to support them. So they had to like collectively, and because of the also the impact of the shortage of livelihood opportunities and working opportunities, they have shortage of the income, and all the neighborhood has to come together to collect money on a weekly basis and then to submit a request to the committee that are running the camp to purchase water. And then they need to wait for their turn, and they don't have water at home, so they don't have water to provide for their daily needs. They need to wait until their turn comes, only to provide like the basic daily need water for washing, for hygiene, for everything that a normal person can enjoy. And this is specifically impacting the communities, for example, the displaced communities, the refugees communities, more than the host community. This is from the climate change perspective. And if you come to the impact of the conflict also, there are like ongoing armed conflict disrupts the livelihood, increase the displacement, and exacerbate existing vulnerabilities. Women face extreme risk of violence, exploitation, and limited access to healthcare and also support system, because the attention of the resources is going more for the conflict that is being cut from the providing the daily support system for the communities. So this situation is like the conflict and the climate change and the weather change, all are combined impact that are affecting the conflict that the challenge is creating a dire situation for women in Iraq to navigate food security, water scarcity, health problems, and safety concerns, often with limited resources and support.
Kaveen, I want to dig into something that you just touched on, actually. You mentioned refugees and refugee communities being specifically impacted by this intersection of conflict and climate. And something that jumped out to me in the report was the piece about Syrian refugee camps in Kurdistan. And I think what you just spoke about is an example of how women are holding multiple identities, of course. They're not monolithic. And so some intersections of identities are particularly vulnerable. What did you learn about some of these refugee women that you and your organization spoke with in terms of the kind of particular vulnerability to climate and conflict?
Yeah, so although women experience the same climate stressor as Iraqi citizens, but the water scarcity, extreme weather events, and climate access to resources, however, they lack the same priority in policy responses and access to social safety nets. So they are not prioritized by the government because of the situation is economic situation in the country is not that good. So this has been impacting the refugees because they are not the first line that the government would make sure to provide the basic services for them. So they have less access to social safety nets. For example, we can imagine a Syrian refugee woman struggling to find clean water, and this is happening actually in the camps by now. During the droughts, not only does she face the same scarcity as Iraqi citizen, but she may also have limited access to government-supported water distribution program because the climate change has been affected lately in Iraq on the water provision, especially that the weather has been changed, the climate has been changed in the country, so there has been shortage in the water in the country lately, and that's directly impacting the displaced communities, like camp-based communities, that they don't, as I mentioned before, they don't have this infrastructure of qualified water pipe to be provided with daily water, for example, and the government is not able to provide support water truck, for example, and this woman has to buy the water to provide their daily needs to be able to take care of the household, to prepare food, to take care of their children. So this is directly impacting them. And this has been the situation for the campaigns for years, but it's like NGOs providing support. And with the less funding opportunities in the last 2 years since early 2022, and the shift from donors' focus to other conflict zone, this has been impacting them directly. So there have been hygiene support that are no longer provided. There have been water system, truck provision to the camps that are no longer provided. And healthcare system also. So with the cut of all these services, it has been a very heavily burden on communities like refugees directly, and also the displaced communities as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Just to build on what Kaveen said, we talked about the cycle of, you know, the displacement for women who are already displaced, and basically, as Kaveen said, don't have access to social safety nets, don't have the status that allows them then mobility, which is something that we heard when we spoke with these women more generally a couple of years ago, was they're really restricted in their options, right? Like they can't shift anywhere if there is a water shortage or if they're particularly hard hit by a storm or drought or whatever the case. And when you go into these camps as well, which we do have, you know, the privilege of kind of being able to go in and out and support these programs. And I know when I visited, it's just entirely held up by, you know, yes, the government, which certainly does offer some support, but can't necessarily create job opportunities in these areas for the refugee women. But really, it's NGO supported. Like every, you know, sort of station or, you know, building, quote unquote, in these camps has like an NGO like label on it. And so when you think about global conflict, again, the relationship to climate change is that when global conflict goes up or there is, you know, any sort of environmental shock elsewhere in the world, it's driving attention away from like these conflict zones. And so these women are really like at the mercy of global attention in a way that is, you know, it really puts them at a disadvantage and it makes them reliant on essentially support from others. And so they don't have that flexibility or mobility that maybe other women do. So even though that displacement is a threat, it's still in the case of Iraq, I think it's at least an option for some women who, you know, are citizens and have that mobility, but it's certainly not an option for women who are refugees in these camps.
This is all really sobering to hear, not only the experience of the refugees that you were mentioning, but also all of your insights into how women are impacted by conflict and climate. From infrastructure damage to pollution, gender-based violence, and you know, limited access to water resources from drought. So where do we go from here? Nisha, the report lays out some specific policy recommendations. Could you maybe tell us a little bit more about those?
Yeah, absolutely. The report proposes policy recommendations across three categories. So programmatic approaches or just recommendations for programming generally, funding and financing, as well as participation and inclusion. And so to summarize the programmatic recommendations, really, it's a recommendation we make often, which is this need to break down silos across these categories, right? Because as we say, and as you probably could tell from Kaveen's description, women are not experiencing life in specific funding categories or, you know, governments, programmatic departments. So what we really recommend when implementers or donors are thinking about peace building or development or climate change projects and programs is that they think about them more holistically. And through a community-led approach, which would apply, first of all, a gender lens across all programs, which is something we recommend even outside of this particular topic, but to include gender analyses and gender sensitive programming, but also a bit more of a mutuality of including the climate environment considerations to peace building or development work, and also a peace building or development lens to climate and environment considerations that acknowledges the reality of women who are living at this intersection when they're implementing a climate program. And I think that they can do that through some of the participation and inclusion recommendations we make, which is really to center civil society and especially women's rights organizations in these programs and in designing and implementing different projects, but also in broader diplomacy and negotiations for peace and environmental management, and including at the national level, natural resource management. I think women don't want to just be working and inputting on quote unquote women related issues, but they should be at the table when talking about how natural resource decisions or environmental management decisions or infrastructure, what's prioritized in post-conflict reconstruction, so that they're better able to speak to women's resilience and also the broader resilience of communities that are facing these challenges. And then also in terms of participation and inclusion, women's rights organizations also know they're at a bit of a disadvantage not being able to quote unquote speak the language of how international donors are talking about these issues. So I think also for even organizations like ours, we're thinking about how to strengthen technical capacity across all of our partners. And we encourage everyone to be thinking about more creative and context-specific solutions to raise awareness around these issues. And also, what does that look like for women in communities where we work that may not be able to access formal education? So when we think about raising awareness of environmental issues, what does that look like in those settings? So that's a little bit of a mix of some of the recommendations that we make that really focus on thinking more holistically and really listening to communities about what these solutions look like.
I think that's a perfect connection, Nisha, to our last question for you both, which is about a specific recommendation around loss and damage funding for climate action from your report. So you've spoken about the importance of centering civil society and women's rights organizations in decision-making, in designing and implementing environmental management schemes, community resilience schemes. And I think that's a really important point because it speaks to the fact that women aren't just victims of climate and conflict, but they're also really important actors in addressing these converging issues. So in moving forward, we have to center women's rights. We have to make sure that women actually have a seat at the decision-making table, that they have financing to put into action their solutions on these issues. And so I appreciated too your point about bridging this gap between women's organizations and donors. In the case of climate financing specifically and leveraging that for women's organizations, I'm curious to hear from both of you, how can we ensure that these really broad funding mechanisms, which are getting more attention and traction globally, actually reach women on the ground who are experiencing this kind of conflict and climate double burden, but who also have solutions, who are agents of change and can really help move the needle on these issues. And Kevin, maybe we can start with you and your perspective on the ground.
Definitely. And we have also focused on this part of the participation and inclusion in the report that we have the experience, or especially some of our partners that are working in countries like in Iraq and also in Syria and other areas. So the donor requirements sometimes are difficult for the actual fact of the communities that these human rights organizations are working. They have, like, for example, in vulnerable communities that we have difficulty in providing, for example, fuel. And the donor would come and ask for a specific type of fuel to be provided with his fund. So we need to make sure that the donor understand the communities we're making, for example, how this fund needs to be spent, and exactly to understand the vulnerable communities and the difficulty in livelihood opportunities in the economic situation of the country, in the economic situation of the vulnerable people that we are serving. The donors need, for example, I would recommend, in my perspective, to have more visits to the communities that they are funding, so they can have a better perspective, a better understanding on how things are on the ground. Because sometimes they read about and you have and you are not visiting the country, you don't have a clue on the exact situation of the country and those vulnerable groups are sitting in. So you have a specific picture about them and you have a specific limitation for your fund. But when you come to the ground and you see the different facts on how these communities are suffering to provide, for example, clean water, to provide some fuel for the family and basic food items, and you can understand exactly how you would recommend that your fund would go. And I hope I'm answering your question.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I think Kavin really hit it on the head in terms of, and she's doing a lot better job of hiding her frustration, or the frustration that I know we felt listening to some of the stories we did hear from women's rights organizations who were describing like this blueprint, you know, this experience of hearing, you know, or reading donor requirements that really set their own blueprint for what climate adaptation or mitigation program would look like in an active conflict. So like in Syria, where it's like, oh, well, can you please use clean fuel for your program when fuel is already at such a, you know, is so scarce in the country, or just things like that, that again, having a more holistic and community-led approach would really make those efforts more meaningful and less frustrating to the organizations implementing. But I think, yeah, more broadly, just going back to our like a climate justice lens, where we do believe in the responsibility in this broader conversation for countries who have a responsibility to mitigate future climate change shocks and damage, but that also there is a reality of countries and women and communities that are experiencing the repercussions today, and that whatever any loss and damage fund conversation, any climate financing conversation needs to also acknowledge and solve for that. I think we can't say we're going to put off one in exchange for the other. And in order for that financing to really be responsive and to address these challenges, I think, as Kavin said, understanding the realities and also to think about the capacities for some of these organizations. I think we're big proponents of investing in civil society and in particularly women's civil society. And in order to do that, that kind of financing needs to be flexible. It needs to be long-term, knowing that the impacts of climate change are long-term. And also that these women are operating in conflict settings and things change on a day-to-day basis. So that flexibility is critical for them. But they're really co-designing, to Kavin's point, that they're not setting an expectation or setting a blueprint, but that they're actually partnering with and taking the lead from local civil society organizations, and that they're meeting women where they are in terms of how they see climate change impacting their lives, that basically those adaptations need to happen today to support the resilience of these communities and of these women, even as they correct for the damage that's been done globally and to prevent further damage. So that's really where we see the justice in this conversation happening and the relationship between financing and participation and inclusion.
I think that's a really good way to end, really focusing on this climate justice lens and how participation and inclusion more broadly are central to moving forward here. So, Kavin and Nisha, thank you both so much for this conversation. It was really wonderful to hear from you and all of your experiences working with these women, hearing from them, and writing this insightful report.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the new security broadcast from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at New Security Beat, and visit newsecuritybeat.org.